Reggie looked at me and he said, "Sister, I don't know what you're doing here, but we don't need no women in the Black Panther Party." And I'm like, and maybe you've never read the news, but it's women in the Black Panther Party.
When Rita Gay Sisk Jamison first joined the Philadelphia chapter of the Black Panther Party in 1969, she was under scrutiny not only from some of its members, but also from the federal government.
The FBI came to visit my mother and offered her money to talk about what her child was doing and this, that, and the other. And my mother told that FBI man, "Have you lost your mind?"
Protecting our community meant our community had to protect us. Even our mothers, terrified that we would die for this cause, stood in their doorways and stared down federal agents, said, "Are you out of your mind? That's my child. That's my child out there doing your government's job."
That's poet Courtney Sinclair Brown. She speaks with Rita Gay and her daughter, Tandekila Francis, about their family's multi-generational commitment to public service and how Rita Gay's lifelong association with the Black Panther Party has cemented their belief in offering public aid by any means necessary. And then Courtney takes their activist's legacy and turns it into poetry. From Nashville Public Radio, PRX, and the Porch Writers Collective, I'm Joshua Moore. This is Versify.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. If you'd like to support this work, you can make a donation at WPLN.org.
For years, my thoughts about the Black Panther Party were largely influenced by the familiar narrative of countercultural rebels with raised black fists. Just hearing the name rendered for me the image of young Afroed militants touting rifles, bandoliered with shell casings and crisp, asymmetric black berets. And there's truth to that narrative. The Black Panther Party was initially founded as an armed citizens patrol, monitoring the policing practices of the Oakland PD and boldly asserting their Second Amendment rights. But to the people in the communities they served and the men and women on the front lines of their movement, the Black Panther Party's mission encompassed much more than militaristic shows of strength. Less talked about than the episodes of violence they've come to be associated with is the Black Panther Party's legacy of service and public outreach. Legacies that helped to shape a generation of activists, and that Rita Gay Sisk Jamison and her daughter, Tandekila Francis, are sitting down with poet Courtney Sinclair Brown to talk about and share how they saw the benefits of those initiatives firsthand.
My name is Rita Gay Sisk Jamison. I'm an original member of the Philadelphia chapter of the Black Panther Party. I joined the Black Panther Party as a student, high school student. And that's where I was trained to be servant to the people.
I am Tandekila Namsa Jamison Francis. The meaning of my name is a lovable one. It was given to my parents from Marion Makeba, a South African activist who came to America to teach on apartheid. I consider myself a carbon copy of this beautiful lady right here. And so servanthood is definitely ingrained, I would say, in our DNA.
I've known Rita Gay Sisk Jamison and Tandekila Francis for practically my whole life. Both are fixtures in the church that I grew up in and active participants in its many service ministries. But for all that familiarity, I had little knowledge of their activist roots in the Black Panther Party or how that involvement was crucial in shaping how they think about a commitment to service.
What got you started? What was like the first thing that got you into that movement?
Well, my mother was a community activist.
Wow.
So she was involved in housing in the community, stopping the gang violence. And when I heard about the Black Panther Party through some fellow students, I'm like, wow, that sounds like something I want to do. It's going to benefit everyone. And my mother's like, well, why do you want to join the Black Panther Party? I'm like, well, I'm just going to take it a step to the next level, what you're doing.
What was it like being a woman in the Black Panther Party? Was it different somehow? Was it distinct?
It was different. And initially, when it first started in Philadelphia, a couple schoolmates And I know you've probably heard the name Mumia Abu-Jamal.
An imprisoned journalist and former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Abu-Jamal was sentenced to die for killing Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. He's always maintained his innocence as perhaps America's most famous prisoner.
We grew up together, and we came into the Black Panther Party together. And it was two brothers, Keith and William, that first brought us the newspapers about the Black Panther Party. And they wanted to start a chapter. Then we received a call saying that it was going to be a meeting and we needed to be there. And I walked in, I was the only female there. And Mumia and Keith and William were like, "Don't worry about it, we got your back." And that was at the meeting where we were informed that we were all too young to be thinking about running the Black Panther Party. They received the word from California that it had to be adult men. And that's where I met Reggie Shell, who ended up being our defense captain in Philly. They made him the defense captain. And Reggie looked at me and he said, "Sister, I don't know what you're doing here, but we don't need no women in the Black Panther Party." And I'm like, "And maybe you've never read the news, but it's women in the Black Panther Party." And Reggie was one of those men that felt women needed to be home. And that was how a lot of men, I found out later, felt in the Black Panther Party. But they ended up having to come around.
While the Black Panther Party is perhaps best known for the men who founded the movement, by 1969, when Rita Gay joined the party, over 60% of its membership were women. And they served alongside their male counterparts at the vanguard of the Black Panther Party's community outreach initiatives, establishing clothing drives, helping to operate free clinics, offering screening for sickle cell anemia, and providing resources to the most vulnerable members of their communities. And these types of social programs played a large part in attracting Rita Gay to the movement.
Everything that they did just seemed like it was going to be something that was going to help our community. And that's what I was about, helping our community. Anything that would help to make us self-sufficient. Even though we had to work a little bit harder than the other youth our age because they weren't doing that, but we felt like we were doing something good. Because I don't remember the original person that said it, but it stuck in my mind forever. Service is the rent we pay for the space we occupy on God's earth. And it was an opportunity for me to be able to help others and be around other people that wanted to help. They didn't just have their hand out for giving, but they were helping. If that meant getting up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to feed children breakfast so that they could go to school and learn, because if they were in school and had stomach pains from not being able to eat, then they couldn't learn. So we fed them.
The Free Breakfast for Children program was one of the banner initiatives of the Black Panther Party. It gained wide popularity in low-income communities and helped strengthen the BPP's relationship to the people they aim to serve, while also highlighting the shortcomings of the federal government's own free lunch programs. Ironically, though, social initiatives like the Free Breakfast program would also come to be a central point of contention between Black Panther Party leadership, highlighting a schism between Huey Newton, one of the founders of the party, and Eldridge Cleaver, the BPP's Minister of Information, over where to focus party resources, on social programming or radical political opposition. A schism that, ultimately, helped contribute to the dissolution of the party. But in the case of Rita Gay, carrying out initiatives like the Free Breakfast Program only helped to strengthen her commitment to service. And Rita Gay carried her ideals beyond the prep kitchen and the picket line into her professional life. She became a community organizer and helped coordinate the 1997 Million Woman March. She joined the East Poplar Neighborhood Advisory Council and secured a 7-figure housing grant from HUD to develop single-family home ownership in North Philly, and negotiated with the city to ensure that the properties were built. For Rita Gay, serving her community was never just flash-in-the-pan activism. It was a way of life.
I want to ask you another question. So you basically started crying as soon as you sat down. And I'm wondering, you know, Is this a story that you've told before?
Several times.
Yeah, and you, it's deeply emotional for you. And why is that?
I'm one of those people. If I'm out there, I can fight for other people. If I'm out there in the battle for somebody else, I can do it. And I'm on a mission, so I'm not crying. But I'm sincere about it. It's very close to my heart. And just like I can cry, I can fight for my people.
But you have a good network, too. You have your family.
Yes.
You have close people mm-hmm. that you can cry with.
Yes, yes. Mm.
What is that like, having...
Sister.
Sister friends.
Yes,
oh,
I still
that.
Have my same sister friends that are my comrades from the Black Panther Party. And after I'm finished my battle and I'm sitting talking to my friends about it, then I may show, you know, my true feelings about how deep it is to me.
Part of the reason Rita Gay is so passionate, why she's using terms like battle and fight to describe the work she and the other Panthers were involved in, is because of the high stakes of that activism, both for the people she was serving and for Rita Gay herself.
A lot of young Panthers lost their lives in their service to the people because J. Edgar Hoover, with his COINTELPRO, was determined to destroy the Black Panther Party.
FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover today asserted that the Black Panthers represent the greatest internal threat to the nation. Hoover said the Panthers have perpetrated numerous assaults on police and have engaged in violent confrontations throughout the country.
COINTELPRO stands for Counterintelligence Program. It was a series of FBI projects aimed at undermining, discrediting, and keeping heavy surveillance on U.S. political organizations. It was founded under the FBI's first director, J. Edgar Hoover, who had a habit of labeling whatever interest group the program was targeting at the time the greatest threat to national security. A claim he leveled at Martin Luther King even before the Black Panther Party. Some of the tactics utilized through COINTELPRO included spreading misinformation, infiltrating political organizations' inner circles, and using deadly force. And Courtney asks Rita Gay, given the risks of the work she was doing, what her family thought about her decision to join the BPP.
How did your mom feel? You said she kind of questioned you a little bit. Was she scared for you?
Well, my mother always, she said, well, you know how you were raised and you're going to have to be careful. And I'm like, well, the Revolutionary People's Constitutional Convention is going to be held in Philly. Why don't you come?
The Revolutionary People's Constitutional Convention was a conference held in Philly in September of 1970. It was organized by the Black Panther Party with the aim of redrafting the United States Constitution with the help of other activist movements like the Women's Liberation Movement, the American Indian Movement, and the anti-war effort. The convention was part of the BPP's broadening interest in joint liberation, expanding the party's goals beyond Black self-defense.
And my mother attended the Revolutionary People's Constitutional Convention, and she met some of the leaders, and she realized I was going to do it, and she said, I'll support you.
And it wasn't long before her mother had to put that claim of support to the test.
After I was in it for a while, the FBI came to visit my mother and offered her money to talk about what her child was doing and this, that, and the other. And my mother told that FBI man, have you lost your mind? Do you realize this is my child that's doing something that this government should be doing? And you expect me to do something that's going to put my child in detriment? She said, all the money in the world doesn't mean more to me than my children.
You might say that staunch commitment, whether to a loved one or a worthwhile cause, is a hereditary trait in the Sisk family, one that Rita Gay inherited from her mother and that, in concert with her faith, played a large role in shaping how she raised her daughter, Tandakila, who in turn is striving to instill that same value in her own kids.
I think that the main goal of every generation is to impart what you have to your children, but then strive for them to step to a higher level. And I think that activism has taken a new role. You know, the goal is to be as wise as a serpent, but as sweet as a dove. So it might not be as aggressive, but it is still as powerful.
Thinking about that legacy of activism, Courtney asks Rita Gay and Tandakila how they remember the contributions of those activists that preceded them.
those members that you've lost, either they've been killed or they're in prison, how do you think about them? How do you honor them?
Well, we just have to see that the legacy continues. We have a national organization now called the National Alumni Association of the Black Panther Party. And we try to educate the young people so that they know. And just this year, we put two Cubs on the board because they have to be the ones to continue the information, to continue our history, to see that our history is disseminated correctly. Because so many people are trying to tell our history for us. And this way, our young people be able to tell the true history.
So it's not just about making sure you're remembered, but you're making sure that you're telling your own story.
Yes.
And your children know.
Yes.
The right story. So what do you think now about, like, young people who are fighting right now in, like, Black Lives Matter movement, who are fighting in Ferguson and Baltimore? What do you think of them?
Emotional. I love it. I love it. Because they're taking the necessary steps to stand for what they believe. You know, they're doing the same thing that we had to do back 50 plus years ago. We were saying they don't respect us as humans.
For me, it was an embarrassment. I take pride in my country, but when you think, why are we repeating history? You know, why did my children have to see that? You know, that should be something that is passed down by oral history, by written history, by digital history, and not by firsthand experience. We shouldn't be going through this now in America. You know, I'm not embarrassed by the children and the young adults that are going, that are taking up arms to go through the struggle. I'm embarrassed of the nation that we've had to do it again.
After a break, we'll hear more from Courtney about her thoughts on the conversation and find out how she takes this legacy of multi-generational activism and turns it into poetry. This is Versify.
Hey, I'm Jacob Lewis. If you like Versify, you will love Neighbors. I'm on a quest to make sense of the human experience through the lives of the people in my community. There's something magical about getting an intimate pass into someone's world and hearing about moments that transformed them.
I was shot within seconds of exiting my car.
See, what people don't realize is that we all have things that we carry that can bring us together.
Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and get to know your neighbors.
It can be easy to think of history as a series of impersonal facts. People lived, events transpired, an official was inaugurated on this date. But when the events of the past are reduced to a catalog of rote detail, the texture of those experiences, the nuances of bias and perspective, can be lost, or sometimes intentionally overlooked.
It was something that she was deeply passionate about. I mean, she said it, like, telling that story and making sure that it's the right story and that it's not, like, skewed in any way by someone who wants to disappear that story. That was so deeply important to them. It means everything to me to, like, see women like that, like, not just Black people who were fighting, but, like, Black women. And I asked her about that. I was like, what's it like to be a woman in that party? And she said, well, at first, like, they were kind of, like, not about it. They were like, we don't need no women here. And she said, well, I'm gonna be here. To hear them talk about, you know, it's not just, you know, community service and things like that, but education. Like, they're both, you know, educators. Like, when I teach my students, like, I'm trying to make sure that these histories aren't being forgotten. Okay, so I wrote this story. I wrote this poem based on your stories. It's called All Power to the People. We cut our teeth on that movement, that party, those Black Panthers. Everything they were doing seemed necessary, just. But we had to learn how to serve the people. By any means necessary meant learning what was necessary. So we got up at 4 in the morning to feed those kids before school, as many as we could, because what a child learns from the kind of hunger that bends you over is not nutritious. It's cruelty. It's cold. It keeps us from carrying on. We opened clinics and brought in doctors so people could get screened, could get what medicine they could for the diabetes, for the blood sickling in our veins. Anything, anything to feed the people. We knew it was right, but it was not safe. Protecting our community meant our community had to protect us. Even our mothers, terrified that we would die for this cause, stood in their doorways and stared down federal agents, said, "Are you out of your mind? That's my child. That's my child out there doing your government's job." Our activist mothers would close doors on federal agents, breathe into the wood grain, whisper, "Oh Lord, my Lord, I raise my children under you. Oh God, I lift my head up, bare my neck to you, dear Father, keep my hand firm. Keep my children's teeth sharp, those bellies full, those minds alive. My God, please don't let us lose our true stories." The stories are in the names now, and the names are important. It's important to remember them. When our people are lost, when they get jailed, or exiled, or killed, we make sure to hold on to their names. We name our clinics after them, our parks, our programs, our scholarships. We make sure the children remember those names and don't lose them. We give our children names that come from Africa, names that mean things like lovable child. Tell them, don't you forget where that name came from. Don't you forget who bled for that name. Don't forget the cost. Everything we did was self-defense to protect our people. It was everything those young people are doing now in Ferguson, in Baltimore, everywhere, everywhere. We are still doing our government's job, taking pictures, taking names. And how deeply embarrassing to look at my nation, to have to fight this fight all over again like it never ended. Like they forgot what we did, like they weren't listening when we told them we will not stand for this. To see police officers still killing our activists, our children, and going back to work, getting the benefit of the doubt. But look at those children, all of them, my children. They have not forgotten how to fight. Look how they will stand up as necessary, lay down when necessary, how they are willing to die to bring power to their people. I know when I look at them that they go home to their own sister friends and they must sob as I do in the arms of the people they love. But I know too that they are cutting their own teeth, wrapping their own wounds, filling their bellies and sharpening their minds against a nation that would devour them like cattle, like grain. When I look at those young people, I love them. I love their power, their black power, the mad love in their throats, the crazy hot blood that drives them. I love their voices, their memories, the hot, dark swell of their crowds. I love them for fighting and for remembering their names.
Beautiful.
It is beautiful.
I love the way you connected the generations. I love the way you established the foundation, included mothers and grandmothers and sisters and daughters. And I think that that's important because it lets you understand the legacy, where it's not a single generation that does one thing. It's not one individual that does something, but that a legacy goes on.
Versify is a production of Nashville Public Radio and The Porch, which trains our poets and hosts our storytelling events. Editing for this episode came from WPLN's Mac Linebaugh, with additional editing from Anita Bug. The episode was written and produced by me, Joshua Moore. Carl Peterson masters the show. The music was by Blue Dot Sessions, courtesy of the Free Music Archive. Versify is distributed by PRX. If you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to subscribe to the show, leave us a rating or review in Apple Podcasts, it really does help, or send us your feedback to versifypodcast@wpln.org. We'd love to hear from you. And tune in again to hear the beauty of how we can turn your life into poetry, one verse at a time.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.